Capitol Report is a production of Senate Media Services.
This week, key lawmakers advocate for bills to avert a tax hike on businesses and to rebuild the nursing profession. Plus, University of Minnesota athletes express their frustration on canceled sports programs. Stay tuned for this and more on this week's Capitol Report. Welcome to this week's program. I'm Shannon Lurkey. As Minnesota businesses continue to navigate the many uncertainties caused by the pandemic, including workforce shortages, supply chain snags, and inflation, an additional financial hit may be just around the corner if the legislature does not act. Senator Eric Pratt is chair of the Senate Jobs and Economic Growth Committee, and he joins me to talk more about it. Welcome.
Thank you.
Spoiler alert. The Senate has passed a bill with strong bipartisan support that would pay off the debt and replenish the Unemployment Insurance Trust Fund, which everybody refers to as the UI Trust Fund. Mm-hmm. If this isn't done, businesses will see a tax hike. For those not following this closely, how did the fund become so indebted?
Well, the fund became indebted because we had so many claims on the unemployment system. One in five Minnesotans took advantage, not used unemployment to help support themselves while they were laid off. This pandemic and the recession and the layoffs that came with it hit working people harder than even the Great Recession of 2008-2009. At that point, there was a drain on the system. We were about $700 million in debt. This time we were down to about $1.4 billion. And it's just simply we had more claims than we've ever had in the past.
And so this bill would then take $2.7 billion to pay off the debt that we have to the federal government, and then also to restore the fund to a positive balance of $1.3 billion. Where is this $2.7 billion coming from?
Well, we've got $2.3 coming from leftover federal money, CARES Act and America Rescue Plan, or what we call ARPA. And then we do have to supplement it with about $400 million of surplus money. There's really two components, as you mentioned. One, we have about $1.2 or $1.3 billion that we owe in debt to the federal government. We're only one of 10 states that still owes the federal government for unemployment insurance. There's the interest that goes along with that. As of today, we're at about $9 million in interest. And then replenishing the fund, which started at $1.7 billion pre-pandemic, to bring it up to what would be a sustainable level.
So you say $1.3 billion is a sustainable level. Some members of the House DFL have said that the state should just simply pay off the debt and then let the tax on businesses that does replenish the fund replenish it over time. What is the reason to bring it up closer to that pre-pandemic level?
Well, I think there's two reasons. One, Commissioner Grove touched on it when he testified in the House, is that right now we still have a little bit of a run on the unemployment system. And there are seasonal adjustments. Sometimes we collect more money than we pay out, and then other times we pay out more money than we collect. That if we only paid off the debt, we would go back into debt very, very shortly because we're in that seasonal pattern of still paying out more than we take in. We'll expect that to change here in the next few months. So by only paying off the debt, we go back into debt very, very quickly. The second piece is that we made a promise to business owners that we would hold them harmless because many of these workers, hospitality workers in particular, were laid off due to actions by the state. And every dollar that was paid out of the unemployment trust fund went to an unemployed worker to help them pay for groceries, pay for rent, you know, keep their family sustained while they were out of work. And so it doesn't seem fair to me that we would ask business owners to pay that back when we, as the state, in a sense, forced many of them to do that.
If this bill were to become law in its current form, would it then prevent any and all tax increases on businesses? Would basically what they pay in unemployment insurance tax remain as it was before COVID-19?
Yes. The bill not only pays it back to what we call sustainable level. So in statute, we have certain levels that have to be met, and the tax rate adjusts, or the premium rate, because it's an insurance policy, adjusts with how much we have in reserve. And at $1.3 billion, statutorily, we would eliminate all of those increases.
On the Senate floor, you referred to this bill as the moral thing to do, and I think you sort of touched on it, but I want you to say a little bit more, because there was kind of a collective promise to hold businesses harmless. Why is that important?
Well, everybody had to come together, particularly in 2020, when we didn't know much about the virus, to make sure that, we kept our healthcare system afloat, that we weren't overburdening it with sick people due to COVID. And while I might disagree with the governor on how he executed that strategy, the fact is that we did. And to have this be the only impact from the pandemic that we tax, and again, businesses didn't benefit from the unemployment system being used, their employees did. And so it doesn't make sense for us then to say, you must lay off your employees in order to keep them financially stable, but now you have to pay a higher premium in order to pay back the system, because the goal here is not just to cut payroll taxes for business, but it's also make sure that the system is there, stable and reliable in case laid off employees need them in the future.
One other issue that has been mentioned as a potential stumbling block or concern of people on the other side, detractors of this bill, is that it's not fair that all businesses would be held harmless, because some businesses did thrive during the pandemic. Is there any reason why this should be tweaked in such a way that businesses who did well would maybe see a tax hike, and businesses, especially smaller businesses, who really need to not have their taxes go up at this time, could be held harmless? Is there any reason why we should divvy those two groups apart?
Well, there's a very good reason, and one is the federal government won't allow us to do it. This is an insurance pool. Think of it like your homeowner's insurance or your car insurance. Everybody's paying in to cover the claims of a future event. Now to say that some people who didn't use the fund now have to pay a higher premium, while people who did take out an insurance claim don't have to pay, seems a little bit backwards. Every business, every employee sacrificed during the pandemic. And I think just us stepping up and making sure that the system is whole and readily available in case we need it again is the right thing to do.
Now, one more thing before we go. Senator Aaron Murphy attempted to amend this bill on the floor to include payments of $1,500 to people who continued to go to work in the early days of the pandemic as a result of the Frontline Worker Pay Working Group, which is now stymied. That was a pot of $250 million. Her proposal would cost significantly more, but members of the House DFL also support including payments to frontline workers as maybe part of a deal with the Senate on the UI Trust Fund. Is there a deal to be made there?
Well, let me start off by saying we really appreciate everyone who did work through the pandemic. We had nurses and doctors and firefighters, police officers, childcare workers, grocery store workers, construction workers. A lot of people were still working through the pandemic. In fact, you might say, I mean, with one in five Minnesotans taking advantage of the unemployment system, you can say four of five were still working in essential jobs. And we do appreciate that. And we set aside $250 million to thank them last session. But this is a bill that's not in competition with that effort. And Senator Housley and Kiffmeyer came up with a plan that spent the money that we were allocated, and the House DFL balked at it. We could have given nurses and healthcare workers $1,200 checks and then come back and talk about what we're doing now. And it just, even the governor has asked for a clean bill. The Senate and over two-thirds of the Senate DFL caucus were in agreement that this should be a clean bill. The governor's in agreement that it should be a clean bill. And I think the House has to get on board and say, we're going to pass a clean bill before the March 15th deadline that we have.
Senator Eric Pratt, thank you so much.
Thank you.
This week in the Senate, a $2 million investment in law enforcement recruitment passed with strong bipartisan support.
Police officers have always trudged along and done this hard and dangerous work because they were serving a community that appreciated their service. But now they question what they're doing, and so many of them have left the occupation, and there's not a pipeline of new recruits to be filling these roles. So what this bill does, Senate File 2848, is to promote the importance of police officers and finance a campaign to recruit more. Secondly, the bill adds one-time funding to the Pathways to Policing, a program that's been around since 2017. It would add $1 million to that program to promote law enforcement as a second career. Being a police officer is a public service to be praised and valued.
Just days after Amir Locke was killed by law enforcement officers in a no-knock warrant that didn't even name him on the warrant, and in a community where they've been already hard hit by police killings, community feels devastated by this. And I just think it's really insensitive at this time to be talking about using taxpayer money to run an advertising campaign.
You get a chance to ask, you know, the folks at the college, what about your law enforcement office or training program? Well, it's way down. It's, you know, it used to be 60 and now it's 11. And that's not because of the fact that the tuition's too high. It's about the fact that young people, given the climate, aren't going into that career.
I also encourage members to think about public safety differently, more comprehensively, more holistic. And I do believe we need a rebranding of public safety. And it's going to take more than $1 million. It's going to take investing in proven strategies.
And former and current athletes testified before a key Senate committee about the closure of some athletic programs at the University of Minnesota.
Between 2019 and 2021, the football salary pool increased by $3.1 million, and just weeks ago, further salary increases and extensions were given to football coaches, volleyball coaches, our athletic director, and the president of the university. That is money that could have kept our sports. But instead of going to students, that money went to the people who were instrumental in cutting the sports.
The cuts that occurred in the fall of 2020, specifically the cutting of men's indoor track, had an impact on our team. And I say our team because in 2019, the men's and women's track teams were joined. Today, every time I travel with our women's team to indoor meets, we are reminded that part of our team is left behind.
Like many of my fellow teammates, I was surprised, shocked, and disappointed with the decision to eliminate indoor track. We were very confused by the decision, and the explanation was even more confusing. There's a sense of hopelessness and uncertainty for our future as we tried to find the best way to let our voices be heard.
My dream was to compete for an NCAA Division I gymnastics team. The University of Minnesota was one of the top schools that I wanted to go to for gymnastics. However, I was stripped of that opportunity. The University of Minnesota men's gymnastics team ranked fifth nationally. It was where my teammate Shane Wiskus trained and competed for and eventually went to the Olympics.
Yet this athletic department that is so quick to implore this community to help when it needs something did nothing of the sort when it came to saving these opportunities. The reason is, I believe, they did not want to save these programs.
I, for one, am going to be, you know, asking the university to take a long, hard look at what they're doing. It unfortunately seems to be a recurring theme that they make their decisions in a vacuum.
Advocates for the nursing profession held their week on the Hill this week as that profession, like so many others, is struggling to cope with the workforce shortage and other challenges that have been exacerbated by the pandemic. Joining me to talk about ways to improve the lives of Minnesota's healthcare workers is Senator Erin Murphy. Thank you for being here.
Thank you for having me.
I'd like to begin with the frontline worker bonuses, the $250 million that the legislature set aside to reward people who continue to show up for work in the early days of the pandemic. An agreement on that $250 million was never reached, but on the Senate floor this week, you proposed an amendment that would give each of those workers $1,500 in bonus pay, which by my calculations then comes to almost $1 billion instead of the $250 million. What's your thinking on this?
So the frontline workers did so much for us, especially at the start of the pandemic, and they continue to keep us healthy and alive, more importantly, to keep our economy moving. The surplus that we're enjoying now is in large part because of their contributions at the start that bolstered our economy. And we're in a really strong position now. We made a commitment to them at the end of last session, and it's unconscionable, really, and heartless to make them wait. That's why I brought the amendment yesterday. I believe every one of those frontline workers deserves a check, a bonus pay of $1,500, and frankly, we can afford it. And when you think about the issue of inflation caused by this pandemic, and those frontline workers who are largely low-wage workers dealing with increased costs of groceries, of gas, of everyday expenses, a $1,500 check will go a long way. We should put that money right into the pockets of Minnesotans. It will help them. It's a nod to what they did for us. It'll be good for our economy.
People following the legislature may notice that there are parallel tracks between law enforcement support provisions that are being proposed by Republicans and nursing support provisions that are being proposed by DFLers. Both groups say there's a need for student loan forgiveness, for mental health support, and for help recruiting more people to these professions. Are there parallels in the challenges facing both law enforcement and nurses?
You know, the pandemic has really disrupted our lives, all of our lives, in so many ways. And we're seeing a real impact on critical sector employment, like law enforcement, like nursing, like educators. And I think it is our obligation as policymakers to tend to that. I'm not one bit surprised that we're seeing parallel proposals in terms of recruiting and pipeline and wage increases and mental health support for educators, for nurses, for law enforcement. I like to remind people that where we are seeing worker shortages, it really is a function of wages. And we should not only pay attention to the pipeline, but to retention. And part of retaining a skilled, critical industry workforce is paying attention to their wages, and we need to do that.
Let's focus a little bit more on nursing. You are the chief author in the Senate of a bill that's called the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act. There was a staffing shortage in nursing before the pandemic, but like so many other sectors, it has been significantly worsened. What are the underlying causes of a staffing shortage in nursing?
We've experienced shortages across the country for many years now. And in Minnesota, nurses have been calling that to our attention, wanting us to intervene to improve the way the hospitals are staffing. You don't go to the hospital and not get your care from a nurse. They're integral. And we also know, and the data is really clear, that adequate staffing means excellent patient care. So when nurses are talking about making sure there are enough nurses at the bedside, it is because they want to make sure they are providing excellent care. If you listen to nurses right now, the duration of the pandemic has really done a lot of damage to the well-being of our nurses, and they talk a lot about a moral injury, having to provide over this critical time unending care for people who are very critically ill, many of them dying. That's why they're talking about needing more peer-to-peer mental health support, and that's why they're calling the question on staffing. Because if we want to retain our nurses, we have to change the conditions under which they're working. We need to make sure that there is adequate nursing to care and give excellent care to Minnesotans who are seeking care in our hospitals.
This is a very comprehensive bill. It tackles mental health, loan forgiveness, recruitment, as we've already been talking about. But it will also require each hospital to form a committee of both nurses and management to set staffing limits. Why is this important?
You know, this is such an important shift coming from the nurses, for years have said we need, you know, to set a statewide number of nurses caring for a statewide number of patients. And it's been hard to move that in the legislature. So they have shifted in significantly to say at every hospital, because our hospitals are different. Abbott Northwestern is different from Hennepin County, and that's different from the hospital in Staples. But let's put the nurses together with the administration and come up with an annual plan to assure there are enough nurses caring for the patients there. Those nurses are experts in providing care. They want to do it in partnership with the hospital administration. And from my perspective, this is a very, very strong proposal that should be supported by the hospitals. It is supported by the nurses, because together, right, nurses and hospitals together are going to be the solution, or the path to the solution, of making sure that Minnesotans are getting excellent care.
The bill would also require that the Minnesota Department of Health conduct surveys on staffing retention, the environment of the workplace, and quality of care. And frankly, I'm surprised that something like this doesn't already exist when you consider how integral nursing is to healthcare. Why has this not happened before, and how would this potentially change the landscape?
I agree with you that it is long overdue and surprising that it's not there, because the care by nurses is so integral to the quality of an outcome for somebody. Many years ago, I worked with the hospitals and a stakeholder group, including the Department of Health, to come up with an adverse events policy, a list of things that should never happen. And even then, nurses were talking about wanting to include staffing in that mix, and the hospitals blocked that. I'm not quite sure why the hospitals are so resistant to making sure that there are an adequate number of nurses. But I do think it's time for us to gather the data so that we are sure, that we're confident that the well-being of the patients inside the hospitals are front and center for all of us, and that the issues that the nurses are raising are being tended to, but not just because they're raising them, but because we have really strong data coming from the Department of Health.
As you know, Governor Walz has mobilized the National Guard to help staff hospitals in some areas. He also used federal dollars to provide free certified nursing assistant education, or CNAs, to a new pipeline of workers. These are Band-Aids. So is the Keeping Nurses at the Bedside Act enough, or is it just a start?
I think the effort to retain our nurses at the bedside is critical. We know we need to do it. It was a problem before the pandemic, and the pandemic has just illuminated for us the problem with just enough staff, which is the model that the hospitals have been using. We'll have just enough, and if something shifts, we get more patients, a critical patient, something happens in the hospital, the nurses are in a position where they don't have enough nursing staff to do their jobs and do them well. That's not right. I am grateful for the National Guard, and I hope some of them who are working in our hospitals right now choose to make nursing their career. They're getting a really, really important experience. We'd love to have them within the ranks of nursing. I also think the investment in CNAs and training right now is an important measure to make sure that we're getting through the pandemic. But those two things alone are not enough. And I think the effort to retain nurses and to answer to the concerns that nurses have been raising for more than a decade, that is our path forward to make sure that we're always providing excellent patient care in our hospitals here in Minnesota.
One last thing, you mentioned the just enough staffing, and that brings up the issue of traveling nurses who have been used quite a lot in the pandemic. The wages for a traveling nurse are significantly higher than those of a nurse who lives and works in the area. Presumably that increases the cost of healthcare. What is your view on the traveling nurse situation, and should it be utilized more or less, or what do you think?
So for all of my career in nursing, there has always been a role for traveling nurses when, you know, there's a crisis, when there's a problem, and we need extra hands. You know, there are nurses that I even looked into going to New York at the start of the pandemic, to be honest with you, because I knew I had something to offer. So there's a role for us to be able to move, and the licensure schemes in every state allow for that. Right now, I think that why the nurses, traveling nurses, are being paid so much is because we're at the epicenter of a crisis. Those dollars would be much better utilized in keeping nurses at the bedside here in the state of Minnesota. And I hope we move in that direction, and we move in that direction this session.
Senator Erin Murphy, it's always a pleasure. Thank you.
Thank you very much.
Also this week, a bipartisan group of senators called for the legalization of sports betting.
The proposal here is good for tribes, it's good for tracks, but most importantly, it's good for the consumers. It gives Minnesotans gaming options for both mobile and brick and mortar and online vendors. It respects the tribal nations and provides revenue stream to the state.
This is something that people of Minnesota want to see happen, that they're quite frankly traveling across the border to make happen in our sister states. And so I think that this is a win-win scenario.
We're one of the few states that has professional teams in both men and women leagues. We have a lot of national tournaments here, and hopefully someday we'll get an NFL draft here, and that will just enhance the consumer experience. And it's time to shine some light on this and get it, you know, where people feel protected if you know, when instead of a black market experience.
We can't forget the fact that it's fun. It is so, so fun. And there are protections in there for those with gambling issues. But it's every Sunday, the Housley family goes to one of those other states and we do $1, $2, $3 bets. There's TV screens all around the restaurant and we spend all Sunday afternoon. We learn new words like parlay and spread and how many yards Tom Brady's going to throw for. And it's fun. It is really, really fun. So Senator Chamberlain has all of the details, but we can't forget that this is something that Minnesotans really, really want and it is extremely fun.
And members of the Senate Republican Caucus outlined a package of legislative proposals to support parents' rights in education.
The Parents' Bill of Rights has six principles. First, the right to know what is being taught in schools and the opportunity to see reading material. Two, the right to be heard. Three, the right to see their school's budgets and spending. Four, the right to protect their child's privacy. Five, the right to be made aware of any violent activity that happens at the school. And six, the right to be heard without publicly doxing themselves by giving their home address or phone number publicly. Parents should ultimately and intimately be involved in decisions involving their child's education and should be the drivers in determining what is best for their child's safety, well-being, and education.
Every parent has the right to know what goes on with their child in every classroom, every day. Parents are primarily responsible for their children and have a right to know what their children are being taught.
Without cost and upon immediate request, parents can have access to that curriculum. So I heard in some places where some of the schools were charging exorbitant amounts of money for the parents to be able to get the curriculum. It can't be that way. We want the parents engaged in what their kids are learning.
School choice, money follows the kids, empowering the parents. We had that bill in committee last year. We had it on the floor, had a good debate last year, and we're going to put it up next week in this committee. We're going to send it back to the floor. We're going to make it clear that we support parents, we support good public education, and we support the competition that comes from that.
Join us again next week as we delve into more topics affecting Minnesotans. I'm Shannon Lurkey, and on behalf of all of us at Senate Media Services, thanks for watching.